This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week we have another outstanding guest, someone perhaps you may have seen on a lecture tour a few years ago. You may have seen him at an occasional convention over the last year. He is someone who doesn't get out a lot and for you to see, although he will be appearing at the Magic Castle sometime soon, later within the next month or two, from the time that this podcast is aired. But his name is Ed Ellis, and he is a finger flicker, and I think he is extraordinary. He has some really nice commercial ideas, and he has performed at some of the finest resorts and hotels and different places where people congregate who want to have fun. Let me just put it that way. Ed Ellis has been around for a while, and he is someone who can properly answer the question. So whenever often we will say we're a magician, when someone says, what do you do? And you say you're a magician, they say, oh, what instrument do you play? I often just say, I play the cards. And they look back at me and go, what? I'm a magician. I play the cards. Oh, I see. They, again, just don't understand it, since people don't often meet magicians. But in this particular case, he is both a magician and a musician. So if he says, I'm a magician, and they say, well, what instrument do you play? Then he can honestly say the drums, and he plays them well. He has sent me a few of his videos that have been on TikTok and a few other places, and he is pretty incredible. And also has a great story he shares on this week's episode, where he was actually on stage using Buddy Rich's drum set. Yeah, that guy. Buddy Rich. Anyhow, I know you're going to enjoy our conversation. He has some great tips that he shares, I think are pretty important. As a manager of your business, there are some ideas that he talks about, such as making sure that you keep in contact with your clients that you've had before, so this way that you convert them from clients to friends, because people like to do business with friends. Anyhow, a lot of good ideas and things he discusses, plus also discussing his journey in life as a magician and a musician. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Ed Ellis, here on The Magic Word. Today's guest is someone who I had on a lecture tour some many years ago, and he was someone who influenced my close-up in so many ways that I can't describe, but I will maybe talk about this, I'm sure, during the course of our conversation, and I think he will revolutionize your way of thinking also. As we are talking here, I've got Ed Ellis, by the way, is the one we are speaking to, and he is one of the featured lecturers for the Trix Convention, where we are right now in Charlotte, North Carolina. And he was giving a lecture very similar to what we had heard before, that I heard, and there were people saying, oh, this is a revolutionary idea. And I was saying, he said this 6 years ago. You just didn't listen. He's just getting a bigger name now. It's just, he's finally getting around that everybody should have been listening to him.
Now somebody cares.
Yeah, people should have always cared. It's just, I recognize that he was the genius he is earlier on before most people did. It's really good. But let me also say that oftentimes, when, as you know, as magicians, when you tell somebody what you do and they say, oh, really, what instrument do you play? You're saying, no, not a musician, I'm a magician. Well, this gentleman, Ed Ellis, is a master at both magic and at music, because he is a world-class drummer, and we're going to talk a little bit about that and the bands he's played with and things like that. But he is someone who should be on your radar. He's going to be at some different magic conventions. Again, we're at one right now. He's got some that are going to be coming up then next year. And if you're an organizer, you ought to think about having him at your convention. Enough of me giving glowing remarks about him. We're going to let him talk a little bit about himself. Here he is right now, Ed Ellis. Hi there, Ed.
Hi.
So glad we had a chance actually to sit down and have a proper chat.
Yeah, that, absolutely.
It's been a while since, you had actually come through and lectured, I guess, a few years. But you've been keeping busy doing a lot of other stuff. What was the place? Was it Biltmore or someplace where you were, like in Pennsylvania or Virginia or something?
Oh,
remember for a little while you were doing
It was called the Greenbrier.
Greenbrier.
Yeah.
That's right. That's a very swanky place.
Yeah, I was there for a while doing a weekend thing with my one-man show.
Yeah.
In an isolated room, 40 people, and that was the cutoff, and they charged for it. Mm-hmm. And then that was seasonal. It wasn't meant to be year-round.
Yeah, okay.
So that's the best way to explain that. And then...
is there a clientele seasonal there at Greenbrier? I mean...
They're always there.
Is there a golf course or something? I know it's a... Or is it just a restaurant
everything.
And hotel?
Golf course, actually four-wheeler rides that you can do, something I'm into. They actually have a couple fly fishing guides. Then when you go on the other route, there's horseback riding stuff. So there's all kinds of stuff besides inside of the place. Yeah. And then now I've been trying to focus back on the resorts, because I started on Hilton Head Island in my 20s, many decades ago. That was what got me started. I actually went from one night a week for $20 a night. Then I did get a raise of $25, but I did. That's very serious.
Yeah.
But it was $20 a night at a restaurant in Canton, Ohio, where I was born and from. And then a couple other places around there. And there was a television format out of Cleveland called PM Magazine, which was very well known. And their format was also in Atlanta.
Yeah.
It was PM Magazine format.
There was a PM Magazine, I think, on other television stations too, because I remember
I'm sure
I've
there
seen
was.
It,
this
yeah.
is like mid-80s.
80s, yeah.
And I had done the one in Cleveland, and they were going to have the Amazing Randy segment. And they said, hey, we got an idea. Since you're kind of local, could we film you at the restaurant where you're performing and interject it in between Randy's segment? And I'm like, gosh, yes. I was excited.
Yeah.
So that was my first TV thing I got to do, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that was really cool. That was 1980. It's on YouTube if anybody wants to look at it.
Okay.
Just put in Ed Ellis PM Magazine 1981, actually. And I'll be on there with hair down to my shoulders doing a really crappy double lift and all that stuff.
So, it was a one-man show that you were doing then at the time that they were promoting?
No, that was Strolling Magic stuff.
Okay.
I didn't have the material back then to do a one-man show.
Okay.
No, not really, you know. And then when I hit Hilton Head, that was six nights a week of restaurant work. So, man, I went from one night a week to six nights a week overnight in the fire, man. Like,
well,
here you are.
How'd you get the PM Magazine thing? The TV?
Well.
News thing.
That's an interesting story. Won't mention his name. There's no reason to. I saw a magician on a local show in Cleveland.
Yeah.
And I looked and I thought, I can do better than that. And so I cooked up the story and I drove up to Cleveland. I went into the studios where PM Magazine was. And I said, you know, I was just in the area and I was in the area, right? I had this whole thing planned. Went in, introduced myself. They're like, okay, hi, you're a magician. And I'm walking down the hall leaving, and a guy walks out and he goes, hey, Ed, Mr. Ellis. I said, yeah. He goes, hey, we've got something coming up with this Amazing Randy guy. And all because I had the fortitude to go do that, something came together.
Yeah.
And then I was on TV. that was my first TV appearance.
And by doing that, that's what got Hilton Head. I mean, they were interested, or you can call
I was working at a place in Canton, Ohio called the Leprechaun Inn. Every place that I performed in Ohio back that is gone. I don't know if that's a compliment to myself, but I don't think so. But it's called the Leprechaun Inn, which is a weird name to begin with.
A
really cool old house.
It was a small place.
But music, It was the leprechaun. What is that thing? Okay, forget that. I'll try leprechaun, mean evil leprechaun thing. So, yeah. So they filmed me there, and there was a guy that just liked my act, and I didn't see him for weeks.
Yeah.
One day I said, hey, where's Ed at? He moved to Hilton Head Island. I said, what's that? What do you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, it's in South Carolina. Hey, you know what? You should call him up. He likes it down there, and I guess it's pretty nice. And I think he knows somebody like at the Marriott. And yeah, I got a hold of him, went down for 5 days. He took me over to the Marriott. He knew somebody that worked there. The food and beverage director ended up liking magic.
Yeah.
And so many weeks went by, and I'm chomping at the bit. And they finally said, we would like to hire you 6 nights a week. We will give you a room to stay in until season, because then that room's worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I was still working 6 nights a week off season.
Wow. That's a good gig. And paying you to boot, obviously.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a lodging.
What a terrible job. I'm in my 20s. I have a room in a resort, my own swimming pool. I could walk over to the ocean, and I'm doing stage magic and close-up magic 6 nights a week on a resort island. That's what I
And had all day just to hang out and meet
whatever.
Girls.
Yeah. No. Yeah. No, I didn't talk to any girls back then. Yeah. Okay. Sure. Right. Well, that was all pretty enjoyable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly. Yeah. So... Wow. And then they're like, hey, we'd want you to come to Atlanta. Okay. So I went to the Airport Marriott Hotel in Atlanta in 1984, and it was 5 or 6 nights a week, and lived over there for about a year, then back to Hilton Head for a couple of years. Then I think maybe back to Ohio, then Hilton Head in 90 again. Yeah, 1990. And then I was gone from Hilton Head clear till 2005.
That's quite a hiatus.
Yeah, I ended up moving out west. My love of mountain bike racing drove me. No, it didn't. And I didn't ride a bike. That's a. I'm not trying to find a joke there. Yeah, I took a professional mountain biking course, two of them, in Arizona, and fell in love with the West.
Yeah.
That's all I can say. Mm-hmm. Wow. It was so different and so cool. But then, you know, I had to perform to make money. So when I got there, find agents and perform and all that stuff.
Doing magic or music at the time? Or both?
You know what? The music thing was full-time from about 74 to 80-something. And then when the 1982 Kilton Head thing hit, then it was full-time magic.
Mm-hmm.
But I did play at a jazz club when I got done with my magic job, because the lady in the lounge opened a jazz club. So this was ridiculous. I get to do magic, whatever, and then go play jazz drums. I'm like Gary
Moore.
On the
same night?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Gary Moore comes walking in. The Gary Moore, who invented all of the I've Got a Secret, all of those shows.
Yeah.
And sat down and played on my drums. It was like, where am I?
I didn't know he was a drummer, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Huh. So that was really cool. I got to meet him. That was really cool. But, yeah, and then...
But you thought for a while, I guess, you were going to be like a resort guy, which I would think that would be a niche market if you can get on with certain resorts. It's like a Marriott.
It is. If I would have stayed on Hilton Head, I would have been very well off now. But I, you know, got this offer to go to Atlanta, and I really, really, really wanted to study acting. Mm-hmm. So I
thinking you were going to do what with it?
Well,
I mean, like Broadway or like movies or
public service announcement, voiceover, anything with film. So I went from I was in Dallas in 87, 88, 89, and I studied at the Adam Rourke Film Actors Lab. And it was real stuff. I mean, we really worked on scenes and all that. And I got my first public service announcement.
It wasn't like improv class. It was
no.
I mean, this is real theater.
A lot of it was scripted.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was film study. And I had worked with cameras ever since I was a little kid in black and white Super 8. We made an hour movie when I was in my 20s. It was car chase scenes and martial arts stuff. And, you know, so I was always fascinated. Not a Hollywood production.
Yeah.
But I was always fascinated with all that. So then, that was the Dallas thing pretty much. So I moved out west in 98. That's when... I want to go to the Magic Castle. That's when that hit me.
Okay.
Friend of mine.
Had told you about the castle. I guess you'd heard about it probably most of your life.
Sure.
About the Magic Castle, but you'd never
I was 5 hours away.
Yeah, sure.
go out to visit my friend. He takes me there. Well, geez, wondering if I could work here. Geez, a wheeze. Wow. Oh, my God. You know, so
yeah.
Anyway, somehow I set up an audition and drove out, went into the close-up room. There are three people sitting there. I guess maybe Ron Wilson at the time.
Yep.
I don't remember who else.
Might have been Bruce Servon.
Maybe it was Bruce. Mm-hmm. Bruce, who was from Akron.
Oh, was he?
And I'm from Canton, and Bruce was my mentor who just passed away, John Quine, his childhood friend. So they always kept in touch, though Bruce stayed living in California.
So did you know Bruce prior to that then? Was good
Not friend? Well at all.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
John was my mentor, John Quine, for 40 years. He lived in Akron, and I would come and go, but on the phone with him a lot, working on ideas.
Bruce was one of the first guys, when I went to Magic Castle for the very first time, He was working the close-up room.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bruce was Bruce, man. Mm-hmm. You know, he was great, you know, performer for the Millionaires or whatever his tagline was, and he knew what the hell he was doing. And I only got to see him once and didn't really get to visit with him at all.
But you got to audition.
I auditions, they came out, I got the thumbs up, and wow. And I remember the first week going to perform at the Magic Castle, I had a tux and a bow tie on. Uh-huh. I just remember walking up at night looking at it going, wow, this is crazy, you know? Every night was like, I'm at the Magic Castle.
Yeah, you just got to pinch yourself. Yeah,
and that was in, I think, 99, and I basically been fortunate that they've had me back, except for COVID, basically every year. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Always close-up room you were?
I've never done anything but always the close-up room, early, Friday lunch, and lecture every single time.
Why do you do early? Why do you like that better than late?
I like getting done and being able to go hang out, say hi to people.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that's what I like. I like being over with it, and it's not too late. And, hey, how you been? And go over and sit down with Howard Hamburg.
Sure.
Who is in my way, the professor, the new diverter, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, which he is.
Yeah.
And my other friends that I met there, Alfonso, who's from New Philadelphia, Ohio, originally. Mm-hmm. And, just different people out there. So it's my favorite place. Well, then I'm like, what's this thing? Caesar's Magical Empire. What's that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's in Vegas. It's in Vegas? Oh, what do you do? Well, why don't you send them a tape? I don't know.
Because Ron Wilson, I think, was the one who set that up.
Yeah. So I had a VHS tape.
Yeah.
Of me, I guess, at the castle. And they sent it and just got this word back. Okay, they want to give you a contract. And the funny thing is everybody was so jealous. This guy from Ohio goes out and gets Caesar's Palace. And my friend who lived there, he said, guys were pulling him aside. So how the hell did he get that thing? Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, they put out, as I understand, a nationwide canvas trying to look for talent from wherever.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it wasn't just something they were looking for around an area. Because I was talking to Charles Bach about that, because he was one of the performers, and John Chirac and Mike Amar, and I think Daryl was, and Max Maven, and some other people back then, Jonathan Pendragon. But from what I heard was, Ron Wilson, who was working with that, was not necessarily just trying to look for magicians in and around the LA area. They kind of put out a nationwide.
No idea that.
Because that was why Charles had responded. I think he was out on the East Coast whenever that.
Well, that's funny. You just brought up his name. Didn't know who he was. I literally talked to him last week.
Yeah.
I was, you know me, I'm really aggressive trying to get back in the convention thing again.
Right.
I've been off the convention circuit for about 10 years.
You were.
And Charles was really nice. He said, hey, you're in the hat and we're meeting next week. And then I come to find out he's the Magic on the Beach Myrtle guy.
That's
and
right.
Different people have been mentioning his name. Then him and I talked. You work Caesars? Yeah, so did I. What? You know, so, and Michael, who was actually my silent mentor.
Michael Amar's been your silent mentor?
For millions of years.
Did he know that he was your mentor? When you say a silent mentor, what do you mean?
Okay, the best thing I can say is I met him 45 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was from Ohio. He was from, you know,
Virginia.
Bluefield, West Virginia.
Yeah.
A little nowhere town, you know, and managed to totally rise to fame.
I think Gary Plants was from the same area there.
I'm not sure.
But anyhow,
Michael, when I was in the beginning, was really good to me. You know, like he would even send me a postcard from the Magic House, and I was like, "Holy, that was cool!"
Yeah.
And so my biggest joy was for me looking up to somebody like that, being on the same bill.
Yeah.
At Magi Fest, me, Michael Amar. John Ace Palmer. I mean, you know, that's crazy that you can get to that point. It's like, oh my God, I'm on with Michael Amar, you know? Yeah, I love him and his teachings are great. But the thing that I studied a lot was that little manuscript, Psychology and Magic. And it had this little Enter the Magician's Hut. And he had 100 of them with a staple in it. And the psychological writings that he put in there, I copied them, put them up on my wall in my bedroom, so when I walked past him, I would see him. And I studied that stuff a lot.
Different anecdotes and platitudes.
Yeah, things like the importance of lying, you know, which is you're lying for entertainment. You're not meaning to be deceitful. It's a deceitful human being, you know, but just the commitment in when you're telling certain things, not all of them are true stories. You're lying. But it's for entertainment purposes. And
life or living.
I would never use lies in real life. I mean, you know.
Unless I was an attorney.
Well, no. Or any whatever politician. We won't go there, but I don't care to go there anyway. So, yeah. But he was a big influence. And the book that really fried my brain was Encore 3. Encore 3, yes. It had Roger Clouse's Bill Switch in it, which I adapted into my Bill and Lemon. And it had, I forget it, Card in Box. I'll do it for you. It's basically you're shuffling the cards, shuffle, shuffle, and then the shuffled cards are still in the box. Do you know it?
Yes.
It's great.
Yeah.
I've got a version that's really direct, though, I want to show you.
Well, you did this last evening when you
I'm
were
sure
lecturing.
I did.
I mean, you didn't perform it, but I mean, you performed it, but you didn't tip it. You just kind of did that and said, hey, it's still in the,
you
still in the box.
You
took
that out. How you doing?
That's right.
Oh, I forgot
just
to
a quick
take these out of the box.
Take them out of the box.
It's just like, what?
Yeah.
I don't promote it so much as a, look, they're in the box. It's a magic miracle.
Not. Right.
Yeah. It's a throwaway.
But that was something that was in Encore 3.
Yeah. I forget who did it. Mike, somebody. I think it's in the titles. It's Cards in Box, I think.
Like Mike Skinner or somebody?
No, it wasn't Mike Skinner. I can't remember the last name. Mm. There is a copy of it down there. I've got to get it. Somebody has a copy for sale.
Don Bursell probably
has
it.
It's tattered. It's only $25. And when I open it, it just takes me back decades.
Such memories,
going,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was a silent mentor. As you said, you had those things, I guess, kind of pasted around.
Absolutely.
So that kind of encouraged you.
And
that's a really good tip right there as far as having things that will remind you to do something and to empower you also that are written down because it's something that you see and it reminds you every day as opposed to
so
trying to remember something.
Down from what I study, it's really important and powerful.
Yeah.
You know, because I consider and think, okay, I want to do this and I want to do that. But when I sit there and go, okay, what are some things I'd like to see accomplished for this week?
Yeah.
I can think them, but if I put, okay, 4 calls to agent, 3 calls to convention people. Do I always stick with them? No. Do I wish I did? Yeah. But if you do stick with them, you know something's going to get done.
That's right.
But that's my best explanation.
Yeah.
You know,
I think I remember David Hira telling me something about where he would call, make at least 3 calls a day. I think it was him who was telling me about this, about making 2 clients that you have had in the past, just as a reminder or just calling up, say, how's it going?
All
because obviously people like to do business with friends. So you're not necessarily trying to schmooze them a little bit and get to know them better. You know, how are the kids doing? So just call them and check in. Not because I'm looking for a job, but I just want to see how things are doing. And I know you got maybe something coming up later this year or whatever, or we just had a great time last year doing such and such at your conference.
That's
or
exactly
something.
Right.
So if you make these calls to people, they're going to put you kind of in the front of their mind.
And they're easier.
Yes, they're easier because they're already
I do tons
clients
of
who become
brutal
friends.
Cold call stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Call up, which sometimes work. I recently did Labor Day at the Ritz-Carlton. It's ridiculously nice on Amelia Island, Florida. Sure. It's wonderful.
I played golf out there. Beautiful place, yeah.
It's, boy, is it wonderful. And all because I made these calls and I've got this idea. I ended up doing 2 hours of close-up on Labor Day. Then my one-man show was featured that night, and it went great, and they paid really good, and it was great. But mm-hmm. like you say, you know, I've got my little list of did this for them.
Yeah.
You'll just call up and go, hey, I wonder if those clients are doing anything this year. And you usually get the voicemail because nobody, business people, don't answer the phone anymore.
That's true.
Which.
Or they may not recognize the number coming in.
Yeah, sure. That's a lot of it too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, yeah. But I try to do 15 a day. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. I don't always hit that mark. Mm-hmm. I wish I did 50 because I'd be doing a lot better. But I even struggle sometimes with 15, you know, but now, I try.
What about emails? Do you send emails to clients then as well? Or do you,
sure.
do you ever do handwritten letters or postcards?
No.
Okay.
It's all, and surely I did mm-hmm. back in the day.
Sure.
But now.
Nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now. I think emailing can get really, really, really frustrating because, you know, let's say, you know, it's not like you're trying to get your car fixed. Oh,
yeah.
Hey, I'm a magician. It's not like, no, we don't need magicians on a regular basis usually, unless you get the right place.
Yeah.
And they right. use them all the time.
Right.
Sure. But, yeah, the best way if you can talk to somebody, and the best way beyond that is in person. If I can do something in their hand, I got them. I
right.
got them.
Yeah, well, of course. If you can be one-on-one with them, and nowadays you can do Zoom calls, but even that is not quite the same as actually going and making calls into their offices.
Right, yeah.
And doing something.
You know what the problem is?
Hmm.
The problem is, and it persists 95% of the time or more, is, now this is in general, people's perception of magic. Okay. I think that when you're talking to a person to do a home party or it's a business person, you say, do you have a Christmas thing? Oh, yeah, we do a Christmas party over at the whatever.
Yeah.
And you do magic? Yeah. You know, people aren't geared to an art form of magic and sleight of hand. If you're good enough to present it like that, they're still in the rabbit out of the hat world. I show up, they're like, where's your stuff?
Yeah.
I'm ready. Huh?
Yeah. Okay.
You know, that's what
you think
I'm trying
props.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Even though you've had the David Blaines and America's Got Talent has brought a lot of visibility to magic.
That's right.
It really has, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I heard the other day about why magicians have recently captured the attention of America's Got Talent, whereas in the early years, you couldn't get arrested as a magician. I mean, on America's Got Talent. And the reason was YouTube, is that America's Got Talent realized that people, the general public, is watching and putting eyes on the magic videos on YouTube. They're not watching someone who's got a dog is run between their legs or someone who is a sand artist. Well, a sand artist maybe, but some weightlifters or whatever, or gymnasts or whatever. They're not getting the views, not getting the hits that magicians are. And they started realizing if we as AGT can associate our brand with magic and magicians, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. we will be getting more hits and people will start to tune in and we can sell our product and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so all of a sudden, then Simon and the rest of the crew, I think, have just had a paradigm shift, basically, to use an old term. Like,
oh, wait a minute. This is a good idea.
That's right. It really is good for AGT. We need to have more magicians.
Cornball.
That's right.
You know?
It's not like what you're saying. They were not with a rabbit in a hat.
And the people that display it, they have to be really good at the craft.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be really good at the craft. Like, and present it in a visual art form. Like, here's an object, pow, it changes. There wasn't any work to do it. What? You know, so that's what I think. Yeah, when you're talking about products, you have Magic Chef, Keebler Cookies, the magic, whatever, you're starting to see the word magic in, you know, insurance company stuff, in writings.
That's true.
Oh, well, a magical experience. And, right, you know, it's all corny because they don't know what to say or do. But I'm going, okay, keep using that word. Okay, that works for me. And then you call them up and go, hey, I see you have magic in your promo. Yeah. Hey, what about, oh, well, well, that's kind of a good idea. Yeah, I know that. So I'm going to come over and it's like, Jack Goldfinger, book the show, do the show, cash the check. That's Jack.
There you go. Well, I remember Walter Blaney saying something along that same
He's
line.
Awesome.
I was saying, what was, I said, I'm not sure the show went all that great. He said, well, did they pay you? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, they must have liked it.
Good enough.
That's right. You got paid, didn't you?
Yep. That's
Do you
that's
think
great.
We're in a golden age of magic?
Wow. I think that we have a good chance. And again, that doggone YouTube and America's Got Talent brought a resurgence, I think, of visibility to it, you know? What? Yeah, sure. I think there were, I guess so. I mean, the golden age, the first one had to have been the Thurston Houdini
exactly.
Live stage.
Big stage
that was
shows.
Gold. That was, yes. You'll never get that back.
That is correct.
Never. That was a piece of time. Boy, that would have been cool to live in that, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
No TV, how underexposed it was.
Sure. Yeah.
You know?
That's why Houdini was doing the upside down straitjacket escape suspended and doing things, you know, jumping off of the bridges and all that to create attention in the newspaper to drive people. But he had to do it city after city because
it was media, written media.
Right. There wasn't any radio. Well, it was radio, but there wasn't any television or anything to promote that. So you had to have, and also the posters that would go up around town for
if you
Carter
wanted it,
Gray.
You had to go see it.
That's right.
If you wanted to see a movie, you had to go to the theater, end period, done.
Right.
Like when I was a kid, I remember Wizard of Oz was on once a year.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yes.
Oh, we're going to watch Wizard of Oz. Cool.
That was a big thing.
You know, there.
Sure.
Yeah.
But today, obviously, as you said, I guess we have so many different social media and different ways of experiencing magic.
It's blasted into oblivion in a way. It's not all good.
But, well, that's true, too, which gets to a point I was about to say. As far as YouTube, there have been a lot of haters who have been saying that it's exposure of magic, but has that been a good thing from the standpoint that it has exposed magic to people who otherwise wouldn't have gotten into magic or gotten interested in thinking, well, it's too difficult for me, but it's like, hey, I guess that is easy. Maybe I can do something like this, and they start
That's a really interesting way to look at it. I personally don't expose the method for my stuff. If you go on YouTube, I'm doing stuff. I'm at the Magic Castle doing stuff. I have little movie trailers, you know, when I was doing the DVD series for you through Texas 10 years ago. But I don't teach magic on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do that. And then you've got, well, no sense in naming names, people who just show you how to do everything.
Right.
I don't know. You know, on the other side, you and I both know that about 99% of the people aren't going to work on it that much to make it look as good as what you're looking at, that they're even showing. When you show somebody, you do this and you do this and they're like, what? I mean, you know, it's not like you can just pick up sleight of hand and do it. You know what I mean?
It is a skill that is learned that takes time and effort.
To do well, like
to
anything
do well.
Else.
Exactly. It can be done poorly, and that's one way of exposing it, by doing something poorly.
Yeah, I guess in the perfect world, I'd rather not see it exposed on YouTube.
But do you think that has led to this being a golden age of magic? By having, I'm using exposure as a different kind of a word, to explain how it's done, but exposure meaning people have not seen magic done well before until now, and they're seeing more on television. Like,
as far as the sleight of hand,
AGT and Penn and Teller.
I mean, we had Copperfield for years.
Masters. Yeah, it used to be just
Clorox
Copperfield.
Thing shows. But, you know, 99% was stage and dramatic theatrical things.
Yeah, people are exposed more to magic than they were before. That's why I'm saying
But now everybody's really, you know, really fascinated. You know that every person you do sleight of hand for, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but they're like, you know, this is the stuff I like. You know, on stage, you know, I mean, you're far away. And,
right. I know they must be doing something.
It isn't exactly true what they're saying. There are stuff on stage. I don't know how they're doing it. Mm-hmm. I sit there and go, what did I just look at? Mm-hmm. And I don't care. Because I want some wonderment to be
I'm
with
you 100%. I'm glad you said that. I remember the first time seeing Siegfried and Roy.
I just don't care how stuff's done on stage.
I don't care because I'm not going to be doing that. And that was my point. I remember seeing Lynette Chappelle appear like a tiger to a woman, you know, just suspended in midair. And I thought, I don't want to know. I'd want to be amazed because I'm not going to do that. If it's something that, like what you do as a magician and a couple of your card productions and some rubber band stuff, it's like, I love that. I'd like to learn how to do that, and I think that's within my abilities. I'm not going to buy this big drop-down illusion where it's a tiger to woman thing. So since I'm not going to buy it, I'm not going to do it, and so therefore I'd rather be amazed and not know how it's done.
I know. And why would I make my personal jet disappear? I love it so much. And I've been meaning to fly over and pick you up for lunch. Well, why would I make my jet disappear? Oh, wait. Wait, I don't have one. Wait.
Well, there has to be.
I sold it. I got rid of it before I knew you.
Well, now you're getting into another area about not the process, but the reasons about why you do stuff again. Obviously, like the Statue of Liberty, you know, his idea was, what if we didn't have the liberties we have? And this represents the liberty and freedom. And without that, we wouldn't have freedom. We can't do the things that we want.
Cool.
There is a reason for doing something. And do you feel like whenever that you are presenting magic, you're doing it as bubblegum for the eyes, like Mike Morrow would say, or do you try to put some meaning into your magic?
Okay.
When I think you do a little bit of both because you do some really good finger flicking that doesn't have anything more than it's like, wow, that is some good hand juggling.
I try to combine
cardistry.
The fancy cut stuff and all that with the result of a visual production. Like, right, I'm doing some cuts and then, whoo, there's four of a kind.
Right.
Oh, and if you, let's feature the ladies, then they appear in a different way. And then whatever, then the kings. And then, wow, you see, when these start to materialize, you know. So I try to do a mix that the visual's really solid and the cuts in that look cool too, and blend it all together. So I'm hoping that I'm not considered, just the card juggling thing that people throw out.
Cardistry.
I really wouldn't want to be considered that, but don't think that I don't like it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's ridiculous. These people are doing stuff I'm looking at and going, what? Yeah. It's almost that, okay, I don't want to know because I'm not going to do it.
I'm not going
to
do it.
My stuff is hard enough and that I need to practice to keep up on the stuff that I've come up with, let alone, you know, spinning fingers like plates on the end of your fingers with cards. Wow.
I
love it all. That's my question. I think all of it has a place, and I don't dislike any of it. That's my
What about opinion. Your audience? Do you think your audience enjoys and appreciates that? And do they remember that? And I'm saying this because if you were just to tell a story that would be personal about you, and then weave magic around that. I mean, like whenever I would do a gypsy thread and I'm talking about my life and my kids and my wife and my job and whatever I do, people will remember me for that and maybe not the trick so much as that.
Yeah,
in other words, is that more powerful than something in which people are going, wow, I don't know how he did that, but that was just some amazing art there, this cardistry. Those are two different things, you know what I'm saying?
75% visual. Okay, I think you are too. Talking guy.
Yeah, okay.
I look at it like if you're a magician, for one, whatever you do or whatever Mariko did would be effortless,
mm-hmm.
right?
It should be, yeah.
Hey, you know what? Oof, there. Now the dog's a cat. Anyway, let me have a sandwich. Wasn't that cool? Yeah. What'd you just do?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So.
So that's different from talking about a sandwich, for an example, of saying if somebody's, that's what they've always said, is that if you produce a sandwich, it's like, wow, that was amazing. But if someone says, man, I'm hungry, and then you produce a sandwich, it's something they want and need. And they will, I think, remember that. But they do understand and appreciate, it's like, wow, where'd the sandwich come from?
Yeah.
So they're two different things.
Some stuff gets, yeah. Yeah, how can I break that down? Some stuff gets a little weird about what you're going to produce. No, I don't produce anything that's like that.
Okay.
How am I trying to explain that? That's like weird and has, I think, no purpose at all.
Okay.
I hope that it doesn't have a purpose. Like when I do the cigarette thing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's one of my favorite things in the world.
Yeah.
You're just going along and out of nowhere, I just go, man, habits are tough. Take a couple drags off of it and back in the pocket. And then I go on and, you know, people are going, what the hell did I just see? Well, it doesn't really have a purpose in the routine, but it's a little bit of shock, a little bit of goofy ed thrown in there between, instead of all the sleight of hand mm-hmm. stuff. And mm-hmm. you just see, you know, cracking your neck, snorting a rubber band up the nose, the cards out of the mouth. I also like
point.
To be, I like to shock people. I like to do goofball stuff, and I also like to do very quality, ideally sleight of hand. Yes.
It's
I
a palate cleanser.
It all.
Those are like little palate cleansers, I think, because
I try to combine it all.
People are trying to take a break, I think, in the action because you've done so much rapid fire visual stuff, and then for you to do a rock from the shoe or a cigarette up your nose or something, it's like, whoop, you know, that's, again, what I would call a palate cleanser that between things.
Oh, that's really interesting.
You know?
That's my ginger when we're having sushi. Is that what you're saying? Yes,
yeah,
that's exactly what you're saying.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Everybody will get that. Okay, what did he just say? Ginger, wasn't it?
Well, didn't we have some Chinese last time we were here? I think we went over to dinner and had Chinese together.
Yeah, right over there.
Yeah, that restaurant over there.
To that place over there.
Yeah. This would be a good segue, I think, as far as music, because drumming, I know, has been a passion of yours then, too. And did you tell me before that you had met Buddy Rich, or you had worked with him, and he was intense?
Buddy Rich is still one of the biggest influences in my life, period. Next would be Bruce Lee, but that was later. So Buddy Rich, I started playing drums, I think, when I was 14, and I ended up hearing this drum solo thing on the radio once. My grandma had the radio on. I don't know, and this guy's playing a drum solo. And I'm like, well, I hadn't heard, what is that? And the guy at the end, and that was Buddy Rich with his, you know, swinging new big band, whatever, called West Side Story, you know. So, man, mm-hmm. I ran down to the music store. Hey, do you have this album, this Buddy Rich thing? And he had it.
Yeah.
Didn't have a record player, but I bought it. And we were in Florida and took it home and just wore the record out. And then that was it. I was a Buddy Rich nut. So I saw him in 69. I was like 15. And then, so I followed him right before he passed away in 87 in April. The last time I saw him was on Hilton Head in 86. But my insane claim to fame was I'm the only person that stood up in a Buddy Rich concert and yelled out, "Hey, Buddy." And he goes, "What?" I go, "I challenge you to a drum solo right now." You don't do that to Buddy Rich.
Oh, man.
And that's what I did. My friend got down the seat and he's like, "What are you doing?" I freaked him out.
Wow. How old were you at the time?
I was 20-something.
20-something, yeah.
Yeah. And he curled his finger like, "Come on up." And I stood up and I walked up that aisle and I'm going, this is not real. What is going on? And I get on stage, he goes, "Oh yeah, and those are the drums." You know, like I don't know where the drums are.
Yeah, yeah.
Sat down, banter back and forth, and I'm going, whatever. And all of a sudden he starts counting a song and I'm freaking out. I mean, I can't screw this up. And I looked over and the band's going through charts. I recognize the name of the song, woo, and got into it and I'm playing it. And so all of a sudden I'm kicking a 16-piece band. What? And he's leaning over the piano, staring at me like this.
No kidding.
And it's coming up to a drum break, and I'm going in my mind because I'm going nuts.
Yeah.
And I'm going, how many measures, how many bars is this drum break? Because if I don't bring the band back in. Mm-hmm. I'm going to look like a real idiot.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Fortunately, it got to the drum break, and he looked at the band, went like this, and pointed to me like, go, kid. Yeah. And I did a drum solo on his drums, ended up, smashed the cymbals. I stood up, the crowd went nuts, and he goes, so you do have a name, don't you? And I said, yeah, Fast Eddie. And he goes, oh, let's have a big hand for Fast Eddie. He puts his hand over his, eyes. Is that great or what?
Wow.
Didn't get to talk to him afterwards.
You did not?
Nope. Saw him whenever, so many years later. Oh, yeah, I remember you. Yeah, you know.
It probably never happened to him before. I can't believe that
there's no way anybody's ever done that. And got to know him enough where I got to sit on the bus with him, just me and him, and just kind of be guys. Hey, where are you going? We're going down this place in Florida, this and that. And I go, hey, bud, I got a trick for you. What do you got? You know?
Yeah.
I go, I want to teach you a magic trick. Oh, okay. You know? So I had the self-working lighter that you would push, and the head of the lighter would go into a box that had matches in it.
Oh,
remember
yes.
that?
Sure.
Box
okay.
to matches.
Yes.
Lighter to matches.
Yeah.
Self-working, but looked impossible.
Right.
Because the lighter had disappeared. Mm-hmm. And I go, okay, what you do? Here, go like this, and you'll act like—
he was a cigarette smoker.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. You'll act like you're lighting it, and then you'll just take your thumb and push it through, and there's a box of matches. Oh, wow, it's pretty cool. So— during the next break, the bus driver goes, hey, buddy's running around doing this lighter trick. And I see him later. I go, bud, you got to practice this thing a little bit. He was like a little kid going to the band. Hey, look.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
But isn't that exciting?
That's pretty cool.
That he got a hoot out of it.
Because somebody told me that or maybe you had told me this when we were talking some years ago about how demanding he was as far as—
demanding? Go onto YouTube and listen to Buddy Rich, screams at his band tapes. Hmm. You stupid bastards, I told you whatever, and shut that door. And if there's one more screw up, you're out of here, and shave your beard. And I mean, just it goes on and on and on.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
Very opinionated. And
he would get, he demanded 100,000,000,000% of himself. So here's these young kids that were great musicians out of Berkeley that would just get lackadaisical. And here's this old guy murdering himself up there and just quit screwing around.
Yeah.
Play up to my standards.
We're here to work.
I'm killing myself there. I'm paying you work when you're up there.
Yeah.
That's it.
Now, what about Gene Krupa? I know that he was the other guy who
Gene
was—
Gene was the guy that captivated the general public, which is flair and the way he moved. Huh. He was a big— Buddy was a technical genius guy, but Gene was a more of a show person guy.
Okay.
Yeah. He was a really good drummer, by no means like Buddy Rich, but
there was a great album together that they had.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. They did stuff at the Philharmonic, Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa drum solo battles. And
I just didn't know if they were adversaries.
No, they were very
close
friends.
Okay.
Very close friends. Yeah, like Buddy would hold back until Gene pissed him off one day.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was trying to upstage Buddy, and Buddy just unleashed. It just was ripping on the drums. And the story is that Gene acted like he got down behind a bass drum like something was loose.
Yeah.
And he looked over at Buddy and said, I can't keep up with that pace. That he was yelling over at Buddy, come on, man. Slow down. You're killing me. Yeah. That's the story.
I've not heard that.
Pretty funny stuff.
One of my favorite stories about Buddy Rich, and I've told this so many times.
Oh, the guy's was a trip.
When he was in the hospital in his dying bed.
Yep, the country music story.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Go ahead, you tell.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, but I had to do it. It's the best. Doctor comes in, though, you have to understand, many of you won't know who Buddy Rich was. Go on to YouTube and just put on Buddy Rich Impossible Drum Solo on YouTube, and you'll see how this guy played. So, yeah, he's in the hospital room. He's got, like, a quadruple bypass surgery, you know, and the doctor comes in, and remember, Buddy Rich is a jazz musician. He goes, Mr. Rich, is there anything you're allergic to? Buddy looked at the doctor and he goes, yeah, country and Western music. Is that a great sarcastic
the way I heard
line
it
or
was
what?
That's
the story. What did you hear?
Is there anything that makes you uncomfortable?
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, are you okay? Is there anything that makes you uncomfortable? Oh. Yeah. country western music.
No, actually, it's the allergic is the allergic. True part.
Okay.
Is there anything you're allergic to? Yeah, okay. Country western music. Yeah, that's just as good, the uncomfortable thing. So,
but you heard other stories about him too, huh?
My God, I can't say them.
Can't tell them.
Some of them I cannot say.
Yeah.
And there's a great stories of helping people out, people in the band that were trying to make a house payment, couldn't do it. He covered for them and never asked him for the money back. Very
giving, loving man.
His facade was just a sarcastic, super cocky
SOB,
guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was fun sarcastic on Johnny Carson. Different sarcasm.
Yeah, I just saw a recent thing on Instagram that was him playing on Johnny Carson, and hadn't seen that in so many years.
Oh, there's a lot of good,
wonderful.
There's a lot of good, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff on here.
Yeah.
I liked his lines, like, you know, somebody in the audience takes a picture and he goes, "Oh, you should have told me, I would have smiled. You could have had a first." Just stuff like that.
Could have been a first.
Everybody get comfortable. Gentlemen, take your coats off. What the hell? We've already seen them. I mean, just what does that mean? Just stuff like that. That guy's so far out, he's on his way back. You know, just goofy stuff. But his famous thing was the Muppets, and a lot of people have seen that.
Mm-hmm.
Where he got on with the Muppets, he did a drum battle with Animal.
Yeah.
You look up Buddy Rich drum battle with Animal on the Muppets, and it was the most seen Muppet show.
Really?
Yep.
Interesting.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, because I know that Doug Henning has been on there and several others.
Absolutely.
On the Muppets then, too. So,
but anyway,
getting back then to Magic, and we'll start to wrap up over here then quickly. You have, again, kind of gotten back on the convention scene and going to be lecturing and performing and everything.
Aggressively
then
working
are
on
you,
it.
Are you thinking that, I was going to ask you about when you were in Ohio, did you work for a while, or did you ever work, trying to think, in Carmel, outside Columbus? There was, what was the place that wasn't Magic Moments, but it was, I know Mike Close had worked there and Carl Andrews, and that was a Magic restaurant.
I don't know.
Doesn't ring a bell with you?
I remember Magic Moments
in Florida
with Chris Moore in 1981, and then Chris took that format to Indianapolis and called it Magic Moments, which I didn't work. The only thing I've ever done in Columbus, I guess, was the filming stuff at the Penguin studio.
Yeah. Did you do that with Dan Harlan, your Penguin video?
Yeah, Dan was the person who interviewed me.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Good experience, I'm sure.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Boy, everybody says it.
The download I have, I mean, you know, like a 9-camera shoot, the audio's perfect, the lighting's really good.
And the audience and everything then, too.
It was really, really cool. No, I can't think of a place in Columbus that I worked. I want to do the Chicago, what's it, Chicago Magic?
Chicago Magic Lounge.
I want to do that. I'd like to do House of Cards.
Yeah, House
of
Cards, yep.
I never can hear back from them, which quite frankly is kind of frustrating. I'm very nice. I sent them like 500 emails. I've done the Castle. You know, Scott Wells is my friend. That's probably when it ended. But no. But I can't get in touch with them, and I wish I could. So, hello. I'm trying. I'd love to work your room. And, well, Mark D'Souza, who I've lectured at his home in his, you know, really cool theater in his house, but he's doing something too.
He is.
Yeah. He's real nice. We get along really good.
Yeah. He was.
So I hope to do something with you.
Is opening a new place. I think it's going to be called The Vault.
Yeah.
I think that Danny Archer and Marty have.
Yeah.
Smoke and Mirrors there in Philly.
Yeah.
And
correct.
They're closing that, I think, at the end of this year, 25,
cool.
24.
Okay.
And then in 25, they'll be moving it over. To have that theater in.
Okay.
And so they'll be booking and handling
cool.
all that
at
his place.
Cool.
Yeah.
Blackpool is an experience. That was 2000. That was a trip.
The name of the place I was trying to think of was called Illusions. It was in Carmel. Carmel was, I believe, outside of Columbus.
Illusions was... Carmel, California?
No, and I think Carmel, Ohio.
Outside
again, that
of
was
Columbus?
It was.
Man, you lost me on that. No,
okay.
I don't even remember.
So, Illusions restaurant doesn't ring a bell with you?
No, there was an Illusions I used to work at in Dallas, but.
Yeah, okay.
Most different.
Well, never mind. That was kind of what I was thinking. I was wondering, since you were in Ohio, if that was someplace. So
right now, if I may, I very much want to get back out and do the lecture circuit again,
the performing
circuit. I am working. You're wonderful. I'm very proud that I'm at the TAOM.
Coming up this next year.
Next year, Labor Day in Arlington, Texas.
And well, maybe this year, by the time that this actually gets released, it'd probably be in 25.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, anyway, this year.
That's right.
This year, I will be there.
I'm
finally doing Harry's thing in Daytona next year.
Yeah.
We've talked for 20 years about it, just hadn't worked. Josh Jay wants...
Magi Fest.
Yes, he wants a copy of the lecture I just did on film. Mm-hmm. So obviously, they're going to edit. I'm not going to send him an hour.
Yeah.
He's not actually the person booking Magi Fest right now, and he hasn't for years.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. The other guys he's involved with,
Andy Gladwin,
do the booking. Yeah.
Okay.
They actually do the booking. So yeah, and just for
because
clubs,
also they have one over in England called Sessions, which is like a week before.
I've been trying to find out about that.
Andy's the guy. Talk to Andy about that.
Okay.
Too.
So I heard about it, but didn't know it.
Might get two birds with one stone right there. If you kind
you know
of get
what?
Both those. So
if I maybe. And again, as you know, and this is respect to my friend Scott Wells, I always ask Scott when I'm going to do something that I'm seeing in Texas being aggressively trying to book these things. Mm-hmm. I respect Mr. Wells that's sitting here, and I want you to know that he's been really good to me. So the cool thing is in the magic world to try to respect the people that want to help you. And that's why I'm not doing anything before TAOM.
Yeah,
so that all the attention ideally is, we haven't seen it in Texas in 12 years.
Need to see
bring it.
It
there. And that's for you because you're a wonderful person and everybody knows you, man. It's really, really cool. I mean, everybody, the FBI, everybody.
Medicine bottles, pictures.
Pictures in the post office. It's actually framed. That's what makes me nervous. You have a framed
picture.
They
haven't found me yet.
I'm
everywhere, man. You should be able to find me.
Well,
as we wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. And so I always like to close by asking my guess, what is your phrase or what's your philosophy of life? What is your magic word? I don't mean then like abracadabra, but you know, I mean like what is
one word?
It could be preferably a word, but it could be a phrase. It could be a motto. What's important to you? Well, you wake up every day, that's what charges your battery.
Mm-hmm. Striving to be better.
Okay. You should strive to be better.
Yeah. You eat, the choices, how you act, your fitness level, drink more water. I mean, the whole parameter. It's so easy to get sucked into what the billboards want you to do.
So strive to be better mentally, physically, emotionally, and psychologically.
Yes. Question everything.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. What are we?
Yeah.
We're 90% water. Drink more water.
Yeah.
Keep it going. Whatever. Eat of the earth instead of Pop-Tarts every day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Why, that's not answering your question very well.
No, it does. That's exactly what I wanted to hear.
No,
that sounds good.
That's a long one word. I got to do one word.
That's fine.
Happiness, you know?
Yeah. Be happy.
Seek the good because it's out there. It's all out there. Like my dad was a cop 30 years. Sometimes he'd come home and he'd go, it's a big world, Ed. You know what? I'd go, I wouldn't ask him.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like it's all out there. So try to focus on the good and maybe the bad will dissipate. So
I like it.
Water, cup, glass, definitely half full. Right?
I like your attitude. There's a lot more to go. Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
So for the Magic Word Podcast, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Mike. My friend Scott Wills. I've been excited to do this. Thanks.
That was Ed Ellis. This is Scotty
right.
Out. Thank you, Ed, for being my guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. I enjoyed our conversation, as always, whenever we get a chance to sit down and break bread together at the many conventions where we see each other, and also when I have had you on lecture tours and have seen you performing around the country. Well, I look forward to seeing more of you as you perform at some of these places. And if some of you convention organizers are interested in booking a really fine close-up card guy, let me suggest you get in touch with Ed Ellis, and he can work his schedule, I'm sure, to fit yours. So, until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to strive to be better mentally, physically, emotionally, and psychologically, and focus on the good. This is Scotty out.